Hello, welcome to Beamcast. This is the July 19th edition of the ShonenBeam.com podcast. My name is Jean.
My name is Drew.
My name is Clint.
And we've established a complete social network for you guys to check out. Check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/ShonenBeam. We're still on Twitter, twitter.com/ShonenBeam. Please check us out on myanimelist.net. You can search for us there. It's also linked on the ShonenBeam.com website itself. And as always, feel free to email us directly to ShonenBeam@gmail.com. What's going on this week? I believe, finally, I think it's something like 87 days later, BP finally capped the well. To quote the BP Global PR fake Twitter, well, that wasn't so hard. Nice to see that they've finally gotten around to doing that. We have a little bit of sad, not exactly related news. Peter Fernandez passed away recently. He is the voice actor for Speed Racer. I believe he also voiced some other characters in that series. Racer X as well. So a bit of sad news there. Quite an iconic voice of a very iconic series. Any thoughts on that briefly?
I can't speak fast enough to honor his memory.
Yeah. Best wishes to his family, really.
In the world of Shonen, we had quite a blow struck this week in the entire coalition of publishers versus manga aggregation sites. MangaToshokan.com has pulled all manga belonging to these coalition publishers, so to speak, which is really unfortunate. This is the one site that I've been recommending to everyone, given their stance on not compressing images. To me, it offered the best balance of image quality versus series selection. Not to say that I blame anyone at MangaToshokan for shutting down. I understand the reality of legal pressure. This is ultimately a hobby that I would not wish anyone to face legal trouble for, but it is rather unfortunate to see this happen. As this has happened, they've asked that longtime readers would fill out a survey that they intend to pass the results of on to the publishers themselves. And there is a text box at the bottom of it where you can fill out your own personal thoughts. So it's not just a multiple choice survey. Thoughts on how this has gone down, Clint?
I don't know. It's kind of disappointing, but expected. I don't like how it's gone, and I don't like the way the publishers go about it without providing us a reasonable alternative for these sites.
Mm-hmm.
For bigger sites, though, it's ultimately kind of a one-sided beatdown because the publishers sort of hold the entire legal high ground in the situation.
Right.
If the sites are sufficiently big, there's really no question that they're going to eventually be targeted and shut down.
To your point, Clint, that publishers don't really offer anything else, I will say, for the most part, you're absolutely correct, but it should be pointed out any time that they do something positive. And I do want to give some compliments to Shogakukan with their Shonen Sunday website, in which they are not current on everything by any means, but there are certain series, most predominantly Kyokai no Rinne, which is the new Rumiko Takahashi series, obviously of Inuyasha and Urusei Yatsura fame, that is being scanlated. Scanlated is even a wrong word. Yeah, it's simulscanned. It's actually being released in-house with their own translations, worldwide simultaneous release. And then they're only removing archived chapters when there are enough for them to have been released in volume form in America. So slowly publishers are doing something about it, or at least this one publisher is doing something about it. So even though it's not their entire selection, kudos to them for actually moving forward with this kind of a plan.
They're baby stepsing the market right now. Hopefully they have something bigger soon, but the market just does tend to move slowly in relation to these things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what we're seeing right now is a little bit of effort from a few select publishers, but what they really need to do is collect the publishers in the way that they've collected to punish people with legal actions. They need to collect together and make an aggregate site, something like Crunchyroll, where all the publishers can post their material and people can read all of their manga in one place. Even if there is a slight fee, I would love to do that.
Well, and the thing is, they've been talking about, perhaps not the publishers themselves, but word has been out and about that things like this are starting to happen. There was a large investment, I believe it was $750,000 invested into Crunchyroll itself from, I believe the name of the company was Bitway, for very specifically manga-related purposes. Essentially, I don't remember the exact details of the press release, but essentially it would lead us to think that they're looking at implementing manga in the same way that Crunchyroll already does anime. And then you have the entire open manga thing out there, which, again, we've talked about Open Manga in passing a couple times. I'd like to reinforce it. It's been over a month now since they made their big announcement that Manga Helpers is no longer going to host any manga itself, just the translations, and it'll still act as a community of sorts on the forums, and that they're transitioning to this new Open Manga. And they had all these big idealist words, and it's just tons of hype, and they have their blog. And if you look on their blog, they have their official Japanese stamp as a business. And yet it's been over a month, and there hasn't been a single word of actual publishers that are on board, artists that are on board, series, anything.
Like, they have their stamp as a business. They're going to be on the iPhone. That's essentially all that we've learned about it. And that's just not enough solid information for me to get behind it. I was cautiously optimistic. Now I'm a bit pessimistic about it, actually.
Mm-hmm. It's just not the way to do something. If you legitimately have something to offer, that is the first thing that you would promote, which is exactly why this screams of vaporware. Perhaps they actually will come out with a model, but to me it's going to be exactly the same thing as what Manga Toshokan is now, which is perhaps a bunch of manhwa or lesser known, less popular, or independent artists. And, you know, absolutely no disrespect is intended to those different artists, but that's not what the big picture is looking at here. We're looking for the mainstream releases, and that we're being given ethereal word of what we might get down the road and how glorious it's going to be. Actually come out with some concrete facts for once. This entire overarching story of manga piracy has made it to the Wall Street Journal, amazingly enough. There is an article recently entitled Japan to U.S. Stop Manga Piracy. Essentially, there's not too much new information here. It's basically explaining the entire situation as it is, and then it's obviously having to explain to an unfamiliar audience what terms like scanlation are. But point being, this has grown to the point where people, even not just from the manga-centric world, are taking note of this. The most interesting thing that I found from this was the sense that the FBI said, look, we're not going to do anything until you actually step up and try to take charge of it yourself. If you make an effort and you need assistance, then we will help you out, but we're not going to do anything. I don't particularly have an opinion of that one way or another. It's just an interesting note. Any thoughts on it being in the Wall Street Journal at all?
It's a business-related matter, so it makes sense that the Wall Street Journal would cover it. The news story, it was fair enough about it, but I don't like the fact that they're calling it piracy because it's a little more complicated than that. Still, mm-hmm. I think the story itself did a decent job of it, and the more mainstream attention it gets, the more pressure there is on publishers, I see it, to come out with their own platform more quickly.
Clint?
I mean, it's okay that it's getting attention, but it's not really a subject that I, like, have any drive about getting attention to. And like with any article to do with manga or anime, it's kind of covered in, like, you know, the traditional American fashion of, like, this is so weird and barely anyone knows about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little bit unfortunate the way that they treated the entire subculture. But hopefully, I mean, I still remain cautiously optimistic, at least for the entire outlook of the businesses as a whole. You know, it seems as though they are noticing that the internet is a way to get their work out there. It just needs to happen immediately, really. Let's take a look now at some other news, a little bit more comical news even. Voice actor Norio Imamura was arrested for indecent pictures. The 56-year-old voice and stage actor was arrested last Monday for allegedly posting pictures of his lower body on his blog. Now, this is a bit of an odd news story, and you might be wondering, why in the hell am I talking about it? Well, he's best known for playing Emporio Ivankov in the One Piece television anime series, which, if you know anything about One Piece, is rather fitting, wouldn't you say?
Yeah,
I hear he was even the model for the character of Ivankov.
That's
apparently
great.
He's a friends with Oga.
That's fantastic.
Which, it all comes full cycle, and it makes so much sense. It's just one of those news stories that's like, yeah, okay.
I see this. I might not be okay with it, but I understand it. In non-shonen news, but still relevant to us, the Harvey Awards are coming soon, which is, unlike Eisner Awards and other comic book awards, these are nominated and picked by the comic book professionals themselves. So this is a little bit more of a nod from the industry itself. Both Pluto and 20th Century Boys have been nominated for the Harvey Awards. Pluto, obviously, is by both Naoki Urasawa and It's kind of a throwback to Osamu Tezuka.
It draws from Tezuka.
Right. It's not directly a collaboration, obviously, but yeah. And then Urasawa is also nominated for 20th Century Boys, which is his own standalone work, which is fantastic. There's also, again, another Tezuka-related publication that's up for an award, The Art of Osamu Tezuka, God of Manga. It's a reference book. And there's a Manga Kamishibai book, which is a Japanese papercraft theater-related book. There are some others that are not manga-related. It's nice to see recognition stateside for this, though, wouldn't you say?
It's nice to see the recognition. Obviously, Urasawa's not going to pull off a Tezuka and tie himself for the award.
And then some other news that is not exactly shonen-related. Sad day for Clint. Tenjo Tenge is ending. It'll be ending in Ultra Jump, which comes out August 19th. I believe that you are the world's biggest Tenjo Tenge fan, Clint. I'm sorry. This is a sad day for you.
Well, it's been drawing to a close. It's not something that's being blindsided out of nowhere. It was pretty obvious that it was about to end soon. It's been one hell of a roller coaster ride, too, where the roller coaster track was replaced by a dirt road and the car was replaced by a clown face and lots of other drug-induced things.
As we're going to be covering Air Gear every week now, as I've cut up on it, oh great. Well, we'll be talking about how incredibly out there he is. He is a rather peculiar mangaka. Also of some small note, Hiroyuki Takei of Shaman King and Katakuri Doji Ultimo fame has launched his new Yumbor, I believe is the way you pronounce it, Yumbor Battle Series in Ultra Jump. We had talked about this on the website months ago about how he was planning to do this. This is a series that originally ran in Shonen Jump in 2007 for just 10 weeks. It was canceled very quickly. I've read those 10 chapters. I can see why it was canceled. It was not terribly excellent by any stretch of the imagination. However, he was so invested in the universe that he's kind of repackaged the entire thing, and he's pitched it again to Shueisha, and they're going to be putting it in Ultra Jump. So it'll be curious to see how he works, because it's kind of very bizarrely, if you can think of Toriko as like a food universe, if you've read Toriko, you understand how that fits into the universe. This is kind of a construction universe, construction worker, construction equipment, big cranes and diggers and everything. It's peculiar. It's an interesting take, at the very least. So
it's Bob the Builder.
Yes, exactly.
Bob the
like
Builder,
that.
Except if he were like 10 feet tall and muscular.
Well,
You are kind of looking at a guy who's used to rebooting franchises after failing with them once.
Yeah, no kidding. Kong Zingbong. I think the biggest thing to be taken from this story is not so much the story about Yumbor itself, it's the doors that this opens up. The fact that Shueisha was willing to restart a series that had previously been canceled. Granted, this is from Hiroyuki Takei, it's not from just some random no-name mangaka, it is from an established success. However, to restart a series that had been canceled after only 10 weeks, that's pretty good as a sign for those who have seen certain beloved series canceled, and I can imagine what you two are thinking of.
Yeah. Is that going to start again in a Seinen magazine?
I don't see that happening anytime soon, unfortunately, as much as I would love it.
Who knows?
It's possible.
Maybe they'll maybe they'll be included in later chapters of Needless.
All right, let's take a look at the Oricon rankings for the week of July 5th through the 11th. Topping the charts this week is not Shonen, but it is Moyashimon Volume 9, which we have a fairly good opinion of Moyashimon here at Beamcast. Running at the top 5 are Natsume's Book of Friends number 10, Vampire Knight number 12, Minamike number 7, and High School of the Dead number 6. Those are all first week sales. Shonen related on this list, we have Claymore at number 8, Mago at 9, Toriko at 10, Sket Dance at 13 still, Jaguar is at 15, Madoka Box, Kudenai, what else we have, Siren, One Piece is still on here. So this is mostly, for Shonen stuff at least, is a holdover week from previous sales.
Mostly from Jump.
Pretty much from Jump exclusively, yeah. Anything at all to note on this one? A very weak week for Shonen.
Pretty much. There's not really anything hugely notable here.
So let us then move on. We're going to look at some release dates for this upcoming week. First of all is Bleach DVD 30, retailing for $24.99, which is still... I thought that we had moved past these price points. I remember years ago, we were looking at individual episode DVD releases, three, four, five episodes for $25 to $30. I was hoping we were done with that, but evidently not. And for a series like Bleach...
Not the parents who pay for Bleach for their kids, anyway.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's why they can charge so much specifically for those series, because there are people who will buy them just to be as current as possible.
Yes, I believe in a previous issue episode of the show, we've recommended that you steal your parents' money to buy series. Not this one. You know, steal your parents' money for, like, Beck or something, One Piece, whatever. Don't steal it for Bleach. The entirety of Shuffle is out. The Viridian Collection... How does Shuffle make the Viridian Collection release? That makes no sense to me. A complete series for $49.98. Thoughts on Shuffle? I think, Clint, haven't you seen it?
No.
Oh, okay. I must be confusing you with someone with poor taste. Drew, have you seen this at all?
Oh, I have seen it. It's an interesting... It's a dating sim adaptation with a surprise ending, which is about as rare as it gets. It's an alright series.
I think someone had mentioned... I could be completely off base with this. Someone had mentioned to me that it's at least notable because the protagonist in what is essentially a harem series actually makes a decision. Is that the case?
That is the case.
Okay, fantastic. And then Vampire Knight, DVD 1, retailing for $19.99. This I know to be Clint's favorite series, so...
If you really like yaoi.
Now, of course, our entire audience just perked up right there. Manga releases for this upcoming week. Dragon Ball Z Volume 8, retailing for $17.99. That's $17.99 for a volume of Dragon Ball. Granted, the manga is considerably better. Far, far better than the anime. But $17.99...
I think we're talking about the three-volume package, aren't we?
I would imagine so. For that price point, it would have to be.
Yeah, which is kind of reasonable, because that's like $6 per actual volume of chapters.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of what Japan pays for it.
Fullmetal Alchemist, Volume 23, retailing for $9.99. FMA, fantastic series, can't recommend it highly enough, go get it. And not shonen, but still worth mentioning, certainly. Vagabond, Volume 8, retailing for $19.99. Clint, you read this series. Worth buying, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, completely worth it. It's really good. It's about the tales of Miyamoto Musashi.
Yeah, and it's also by Takehiko Inoue of Slam Dunk and Real fame. So the art is excellent. Let's take a look now at our current and classic review segment, where this week we're going to focus current-wise on The World God Only Knows, the synopsis of which is rather interesting. It's a twist on many dating sim-style series. Katsuragi Keima is our protagonist, and he is the god of dating sims. He can win over any girl in a dating sim, obviously. Meanwhile, in the same world, demons can inhabit the body of girls with weak constitution problems in their lives, and so these agents from hell need someone to come and win these girls over, and so classic misunderstanding, they see Keima as the god of winning girls over, not realizing he's just a hopeless otaku that can only win over fake pixelated girls, and our story begins there. So right off the bat, you'd have to say, pretty original idea. Clint, what do you think about the premise of this series?
It's done really well. I mean, it's not something you're going to see pretty much anywhere else. It's the first time I'd ever read anything like it. And it's so well done for being the first venture into this kind of thing.
What do you think of the way it breaks conventions from typical formulaic harem series, Drew?
I think it's quite nice. It does a very good job of breaking down romance into arcs versus just, like, having different romances and never really concluding them. Every romance does a nice job of concluding within the series, and it's set up so that you can do as many of those arcs as you want.
Complementing all of these little episodic arcs very nicely is the comedy. There are a lot of excellent character traits that lend themselves very well to comedy. Does this series not make you laugh more than many other series week to week, Drew?
I'm pretty sure it's the funniest series I read week to week.
Comedically, what do you think of the character traits in particular, Clint? Wouldn't you say, especially one of them, really lends itself very well to a hilarity week to week?
Yeah, Elsie liking fire trucks never gets old. The way her like face lights up whenever she sees a fire truck, her reaction in the chapter when she was taken to see them.
Now, our protagonist is not really at all like any protagonist in any harem series, any dating sim style series, and that's an absolute pro in the way that he just he lends himself so well to comedy. He's far more decisive than many other protagonists. I mean, what are your thoughts on him, Drew?
I think Kama's, I wouldn't call him an entirely unique hero. I've seen ones like him before, but he certainly is a very good hero for the type of premise this series develops. He is a very decisive hero, and he's very good at what he does to the extent that he has helped winning these girls over. He's still very capable of exploiting the tropes in the story. And the fact that the tropes are played straight as opposed to just fall short makes it a more interesting series.
Mm-hmm.
It takes away a little from the realism, but that's kind of what a comedy series like this needs.
Right. Now, the art, it's perhaps not the most excellent art we've ever seen. We're not talking about Takeshi Obata or Takehiko Inoue-style art necessarily. However, it is extremely suitable for the series, first of all. It really lends itself well to the style and the overall feel of the series. But also, there are a lot of moments of parody where the series will parody certain other famous, well-known series, and it'll adapt to the art style of the series it's parodying flawlessly well. Or sometimes during particularly comedic moments, the art style will go a little bit super deformed, a little bit chibi, and pull that off extremely well. And then the artist is also very good with technical detail in terms of just overall overall attention to detail is something that I would note in this entire series. Any thoughts on the art here, Clint?
Yeah, like you said, it's attention to detail. When they go into buildings, just the things you note, there are small details just put in everywhere that makes the art kind of like really immersive, and it just gets you into the story and fits perfectly.
And I think we all agree, best drawn fire trucks in all of Shonen.
Yeah. No question, especially when they're on a plate for eating.
Not all is perfect, unfortunately. One particular con of note is that the larger overarching plot of the entire series is perhaps not as interesting as the plot that you can find in the individual arcs. So if you're looking for an engaging overall story, it's not to say that it's weak, it's not to say that it's poor, it's just it's not quite up to the same level. What do you feel about the comparative interest of these different plots, Drew?
It works as an episodic series extremely well. You can sort of follow it as a larger overarching plot, but there isn't as much to it at this point, and it sort of feels like cheap drama compared to the comedy that we see that's so rich and varied.
Mm-hmm. And given that it is episodic, sometimes it can feel a little bit repetitive. And personally, I haven't found myself tired of it, but those who are not fans of this formulaic style of storytelling perhaps would find it to be a little bit too repetitive, a little bit too reliant on the same ideas, granted using different protagonists and different side characters. Do you feel the same way at all, Clint?
Yeah, like you said, personally, I've never had like a problem with it. It keeps me entertained every single arc. But if you don't like the first arc you read, there's a good chance that the rest of the arcs also won't be for you.
And then finally, every once in a while, these episodic arcs will focus more on side characters than on Kama, our protagonist. And that ultimately does weaken the series somewhat, because Kama is, to me at least, the best part of this entire series. He is what makes the series as interesting as it is, as engaging as it is. And so when the attention is focused away from Kama, again, not poor, just certainly nowhere near the same level. Adaptations, not yet is there any anime adaptation, but there will be one this fall season. Am I correct on that, Drew?
Yeah, there's one coming up this fall. You can look forward to it. It's going to be the same season as Bakuman, so presumably they're going to go a little bit head-to-head, both being sort of meta parody anime. Well, Bakuman, not so much a parody, but they'll both be there.
All right, now let's take a look at our ratings for the series. Clint, do you have a rating out of 10 for The World God Only Knows?
Yeah, I'm going to give The World God Only Knows an 8 out of 10. It's wonderfully well done, and I really enjoy it, but it's not like an outstanding series to me. It wasn't something that I picked up and then read straight through immediately to the end and was like waiting with bated breath for the new chapters.
Drew?
I give it an 8 out of 10. It does very solid episodic arc comedy. Like, when it focuses on side characters, which it's been doing more of, and when it goes into overarching plot, it's a bit weaker. But overall, a very solid, enjoyable series.
And 3 for 3, I also give it an 8 out of 10. I feel that the comedy is pulled off extremely well. I feel that the characters are varied and interesting. I feel that the plot is interesting enough to keep you engaged as it travels to different characters, to different settings. But ultimately, in my personal opinion, these types of series can only get so good. I can never feel that this series would be as masterful, or this type of a series would be as masterful as, say, a Slam Dunk. But this is one of the better series in this genre that I've ever read. So it's certainly a strong recommendation from me for this series, 8 out of 10. For our classic review this week, we're going to look at MXO. Drew, would you like to give us a synopsis on MXO, please?
A kid goes into a magic school without knowing magic and has to bluff his way through.
And that premise in and of itself, it's kind of a magic school that is hidden. I mean, it's not in a world of magic being this widely accepted concept. The fact that magic exists is a complete surprise to our protagonist. So that in and of itself, this hidden magic school, the revelation that magic exists, and then the protagonist, Kazumi Taiga, having to hide the fact that he can't use magic, that's also, as we talked about with The World God Only Knows, an interesting premise, wouldn't you say, Clint?
Yeah, it's definitely like one of those original premises. We have two of the same kind of thing today, that this premise is pretty interesting, and we'll probably have you involved in the series.
The dialogue, I believe that, I think that was Drew that said the dialogue was of particular note. Do you have any comments on the dialogue, Drew?
The dialogue, the way the premise is set up so that he's not a wizard, but he's in a world full of wizards and has to bluff that he is in fact one of the most powerful wizards in the school while not having magic powers. The dialogue, the way that's set up, is extremely engaging, extremely funny, and at the same time a little bit badass, although you know it's just a lie the whole time.
Similarly to the way that he has to cover up through speech that he doesn't have any magic powers, the way that he fights, the way that all these different characters fight, because all these other characters around Taiga in this school can use magic, and yet our protagonist does, as any protagonist tends to do in this kind of a series, gets wrapped up in all sorts of hijinks and nonsense, so he has to fight. The fights are done not only well from the standpoint of balancing him hiding his powers, but just as the way that they are choreographed and shown, wouldn't you say, Clint?
Yeah, the fights are just extremely well choreographed and drawn. The action is pretty engaging, and overall it's a really interesting way to do the fights. It's not your typical, like, shonen power versus power. It's very situational, ability-based.
And yet, regarding those powers, there's quite a wide variety of them. The magic concept obviously lends itself to all these outlandish ideas, which do pop up. All the different characters have a very wide variety of different skills and abilities, which then do make for interesting matchups. Drew, what do you think about the different magic powers in this series?
Magic powers are certainly creative enough and applied in ways you wouldn't always expect. I'm thinking of particular powers that I've seen in MXO that I would not have seen being used that way, but you do come up with a variety of creative ways to use them that makes for some pretty interesting fights.
Now, ultimately, there is one major overwhelming con, which people these days know about before they even get into reading the series, unfortunately, and that is the fact that it met a premature demise, did MXO as a series. It was only 99 chapters long, it was canceled. Word has it that it reached the wrong audience, really. While it seems to be rather popular among American anime fans and manga fans, it never really took off with Japanese manga fans, who obviously directly influence whether a series remains publishing. So all the things that come along with cancellation are unfortunately present in this series, very particularly at the end of this series. The end of the series is rather rushed. I know that we have some different opinions on the actual quality of the ending, but it was a rushed ending, an unintended ending. And just obviously the sheer disappointment of not being able to fully realize the extent of the different plot lines that have been built up. So Clint, what are your thoughts on just the way the series ended and the unfortunate circumstances around that?
I mean, it's a real shame that it ended the way it did. There were a lot of unresolved plot lines that I would have really liked to see a conclusion to that we don't get anything for, and then the ending in particular, I felt strongly against. I just didn't like how it ended, and I know they had to end it some way, but how it ended left open so many things that I was just uncomfortable with being there, and I had so many questions still. It was just really just unfulfilling and not satisfactory.
Drew, thoughts on cancellation and or the ending?
At the time when it was canceled, I had just caught up to the series. I had started reading from chapter 90. And, like, it took me some time to catch up. That's where I was. And then, like, it got canceled in the next 10 weeks. At first, I was shocked, and then I was somewhat frustrated about it. The ending wasn't the worst one out there, but at the same time, the fact that it ends when it does is very infuriating, and it leaves just so much of the series unresolved.
I have to say, personally, I have rather different opinion from either of you. I actually thought that given the circumstances, I found the ending to be rather good. It, in my opinion, it's probably the best, you know, cancellation ending I've ever read. Certainly not the best ending, full stop, that I've ever read. But in terms of a deliberate ending having to be written hurriedly based on cancellation, I found it to be very acceptable. But then comparing and contrast that with the rest of my opinion on the entire series, I found the rest of the series to be a little bit weak, to not go in the direction that I was hoping it would go in. So if you find yourself along my train of thought during the entire series, which is this is enjoyable but not wholly engaging, perhaps you will then find the ending acceptable, or vice versa. If you're absolutely loving this, unfortunately, be ready for somewhat of a letdown, as Clint and Drew have both said. So quite obviously, then, there was no anime or other adaptation of MXO. So let us then give our ratings out of 10. Clint?
My rating is a 6 out of 10. It was great for the entire time it ran up until the last chapters, and it was left out in the dust at that point, and there's so many unresolved plots that I just can't rate it any higher.
True.
I would give it, with a big asterisk, I would give it a 9 out of 10. Because the way I rate manga is I rate them how much enjoyment I get from week to week. I try not to disproportionately balance the ending. As frustrating as it was, the majority of the manga for me is a 9 out of 10.
And as for me, it is a 6 out of 10. Frankly, I was never as engaged with the story as a lot of other fans seem to have been. But granted, that could just be a personal opinion on my part, certainly not intending to criticize those who love it. I found it to be an interesting original premise, but then it moved more towards directions I didn't care for. There's the two particularly longer arcs in the center area of the entire series just to me dragged on and didn't really serve the purpose that I was hoping I would get out of the series. Still enjoyable, still certainly superior to certain similar styles of series, but overall only a 6 out of 10 for me. Spoiler time. It is the Great Shonen Tier List, and this week from our Big Three selection, we're going to look at Sanji from One Piece first. Let us begin looking at the window of Roronoa Zoro as our ceiling and Kurenai Shinkuro as our floor. Granted, this is a little bit of a contested opinion in One Piece circles, whether Sanji is or is not on the same level as Zoro, but I think that I think it would be reasonable to say that Zoro canonically is at this point at least, if not overall, stronger than Sanji. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I think canonically at this point, he's still sort of more respected in higher circles. He's one of the 11 supernovas. Sanji isn't, so. Mm-hmm.
All right, so then let us just cut the difference right down the middle here. In between that little window is Shishio Makoto, the villain of Rurouni Kenshin. How do we feel that a fight between Sanji with, interesting, this is kind of fire on fire later in the series for each. How do we feel that this would play out? Clint, initial thoughts?
Well, the fire from Sanji's kicks isn't really going to do anything, I don't think, to someone who's constantly burning.
Mm-hmm. Just overall agility. I mean, I get the feeling that Sanji is more agile in this kind of a situation, but he is ultimately coming up against a swordsman, which, you know, given his spars with Zoro, might not be that much of an issue, but it's a different breed of swordsman. Drew, what's your gut feeling on all of this?
My gut feeling in this is that, like, Sanji can obviously kick with full power, though Diablejam Fire Leg won't do too much. I get the feeling that Sanji just has more overall power in this fight and comes out on top.
That's my initial reaction. Clint, do you feel strongly either way?
Yeah, I mean, Shishio is definitely a skilled swordsman. There's no doubt about that. He's a veteran in the field. But I feel like Sanji has that kind of a more shonen type of strength to him that would allow him to come out on top.
Mm-hmm. Let's briefly look at Lucy Heartfelia, a couple spaces above Shishio. There's a rather interesting handicap that prevents Sanji from winning this, isn't there?
absolute matchup nightmare.
Yeah, he can't kick girls.
So he canonically, as close to canon as you can get in across series borders here, he would lose to Lucy. So then that takes us to Sanji versus Kenshin. Kenshin, in my opinion, is a far more agile, far more quick swordsman than Shishio is. So it's a bit of a difference in matchup. The vacuum from the Amakakeru Ryu no Hirameki, that could come into play. I mean,
I mean, it's no question Kenshin has the ability to cut him, and I think he is like a tier of speed above Shishio. I would put him faster than Sanji, and I think that gives him an edge.
Does that give him the decisive edge, though? Clint, what do you think?
I'm leaning initially towards Kenshin because I'm thinking about how the fight would play out. Kenshin is just blindingly fast, and the techniques of the Hiten Mitsurugi are just, they're one-shot techniques. I feel like it would be over in the first. It would be over in the first hit.
Yeah. Now Diable Jambe would actually come into play here, but again, Kenshin being so fast, I mean, Sanji has to wind up. He's not going to start with his leg on fire. He has to wind up for it. So if he even decides to go for that, it's pretty much an instant, EI, a one-strike kill from Kenshin, isn't it?
Yeah, I would think so.
Okay, so I'm in agreement with that. So I'm going to put Sanji below Kenshin, but above Shishio. Finally break up our little Kenshin duo there. Moving on, we're going to take a look at, from Naruto, Gaara of the Desert. Let's look quite a bit higher up the list. We're going to have to qualify this statement for you. We're going to look below Natsu and above Inuyasha, which puts him exactly against Crocodile. Now we've shortened the conversation for you because this is just entirely too esoteric to completely bore you with.
It was half an hour in pre-show discussion to figure out how this would play out.
Essentially, we've taken a look. I mean, Luffy's just too fast, too strong, and yet Gray, despite having a potential matchup advantage with Ice, just doesn't have enough mastery over his own powers. So having narrowed it down to sand on sand, Gaara against Crocodile, I think one of the issues that is raised with this matchup is the concept that Gaara controls all sand. So once Crocodile dissolves into sand, does Gaara then gain control of Crocodile as an entity? I am inclined to say no, he does not. Thoughts on that idea in general, either of you?
I think it's really impossible to tell until you see them matched up. Certainly being a Logia user, Crocodile still has a sense of identity that regular sand in a regular desert would not have.
Right. Clint, what are your thoughts on that, and or just how the matchup would play out?
I feel like as far as moving Crocodile like around, maybe he could. He couldn't change his will or alter anything about his mind, I wouldn't think. And we also know that Gaara doesn't have, like, he can't feel the sand. He's not aware of the sand. He can just move it. So right. Even if I go under the assumption that he can move Crocodile, I still feel Crocodile would be able to get in that sneak hit, the off guard hit to Gaara when he's not paying attention.
Right. Yeah, I'm of the mindset that Crocodile would not be moved even. That Gaara would have absolutely no control over Crocodile as an entity, just because, Crocodile is a Logia user that can dissolve into sand, but he is still a being. Sand just constitutes his being. It doesn't mean that he devolves into sand itself.
He's still becoming sand.
It's a complicated concept, obviously.
Logia is a fundamental elemental control power like Gaara's, and it does not derive from chakra, so it's not limited in the same sense.
So, initial thoughts then on the winner of this fight. Clint, you've said that you feel that Crocodile, at the very least, even if he was under the control, he could get in a sneak hit, so I'm assuming that you think that Crocodile would win this?
Yeah, I would say that Crocodile would win.
I believe that issue of controlling Crocodile wouldn't even come into play. I just believe that Crocodile has a better mastery over his own powers. And could Crocodile strike the decisive blow against Gaara? Definitely, because Gaara has no way to... He has the absolute defense concept, but he has no way of completely dissolving his body into nothingness. Could Gaara strike the decisive blow on Crocodile? I don't believe so, for that very reason. So to me, Crocodile wins. What about you, Drew?
Well, to me, it's just a question of Gaara does not have as good defense as Crocodile, because Crocodile can just become immaterial, effectively. I don't think Gaara has defense on that tier.
So we have a little miniature sand tier, and Crocodile has won out, beating Gaara. Gaara will still go above Inuyasha, though. Moving on to Bleach, we're going to take a look at Chad this week. You know, a little bit of a mix-up from the generic, same old, incredible super speed and a sword characters. Let's take a look at Chad, who can punch beams. Of course, why not? Going to have to take a look a little bit lower down the list here, obviously. We're going to first look at below Miroku, but above Ayasaki Hayate. So we have a little bit of a window here to work with. Let's cut it right down the middle, which actually puts him against Sanji, who we just placed on the list. Sanji, again, you know, relatively quick, not Bleach quick, perhaps, but neither is Chad in the concept that we think of as Bleach quick. Sanji has great power in his legs, but he doesn't have the distance attack. Chad has the beam laser punch thing, whatever you wish to call it. Clint, what do you think? Is that going to play out, the distance issue?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I fully believe that Sanji has the speed to cover that distance before taking a beam. I'm kind of half and half on it. I sort of believe he does, I sort of believe he doesn't. The beams aren't slow by any means. I mean, they come out at the speed you would expect a normal beam to come out.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that, like, the other power Chad has, like the shield he has on his left arm, would probably be able to block Sanji's kicks even if he got close. I mean, it's useless against Bleach villains, but it's still probably beyond, like, typical One Piece power tier.
Just for the sake, I mean, I'm inclined to say that he would beat Sanji, unfortunately. You know, being a Sanji fan, I say that. But just for the sake of understanding Chad's powers, is that beam unidirectional? I mean, he punches slash fires his beam just in one solid direction?
Yeah, it goes in one direction. It doesn't arc or alter direction or anything.
Okay, just to better understand that, thank you. So let's put him up against Lucy Heartfelia, who certainly does have quite a wide array of distance attacks. She can close the distance physically with Taurus or with Virgo or with Aries, perhaps. Or she can use Sagittarius to fire from afar. But all that against a beam, a Bleach beam. Drew, what are your thoughts on that?
My feeling on that is that, like, again, the beam probably has equal speed to the summons, and I feel like it would beat most of them. I feel like maybe Virgo and maybe Sagittarius could stand up to it, but I feel like Chad has still a fundamental power advantage.
And Clint, you, for some reason, don't read Fairy Tail.
Come on, man.
You gotta get with the times.
Apparently.
I'm inclined to say that he beats Lucy as well. Let's put him up against Roronoa Zoro. Certainly not a speed character. He does have a distance attack, or a couple varieties of the same distance attack in the 108-pound cannon, slash all the different varieties of that. Versus a beam, certainly Zoro is of a greater strength and constitution than any other character that we've discussed till now. So if he closes the distance, he certainly can harm Chad. Does he close the distance before being destroyed by this beam, though? What do you think, Clint?
We've seen the beam pulverize through rock walls, which I guess it's not much of a comparison, because we've certainly seen Zoro take things that would crumble a rock wall and be fairly all right from it.
Right.
Could he close the distance? Could he shrug off enough of those beams? I'm not certain. I'm kind of leaning towards no, but I'm not at all sure of that. Does anyone else have an opinion?
I would be leaning a little more towards Zoro in this fight, because his swords, the swords that he has later on in the series, are basically unbreakable. And it's not like he's going to deflect all of the beam, but he can probably at least partially defend against them enough to get close. And I feel like he's powerful enough with a sword to cut through Chad's defensive arm.
Well, it's an interesting idea because it brings into concept what defines a beam? What constitutes a beam? Is it just light because it could be reflected at that point? Is it some kind of electricity because, you know, certainly from the fight with Eneru, the brief fight against Eneru from Zoro's standpoint, we certainly know that Zoro would be taken out by that. I mean,
I call it an energy beam.
I'm not really willing to say that he can deflect that, really.
I'm not saying he can deflect that, but like he can probably blunt the impact by just putting his swords in the defensive position. Make it less powerful.
We've seen him use the little like triangular stance where he crosses all three of his swords to block different attacks. I'm not entirely sure that that would stop
the beam. Not saying he'd block the beam, but he'd, like, blunt the force of it to the extent that he could probably take one or two and close the distance.
Now, distance being closed at that point, it's not as though Chad is weak up close by any means. He still has that colossal punching power. This is a tough point, one. What do you...
At close range, I'm going to give it to Zoro, and at long range, I'm going to give it to Chad.
Okay, so it is a question of does Chad win before Zoro makes it to him? Initial impressions, Clint.
I'm going to have to go with Chad.
Drew?
I would go with Zoro.
Boy. This, if I'm the tie-breaking vote and I have absolutely no idea, let's make sure that we are exactly in the right place at the very least. Ganta from Dead Man Wonderland. Clint, you are the expert on this character. He fires blood bullets that I believe he has to take a small amount of time to charge. Am I correct?
Yeah. He's a normal kid, and the blood bullets take a little bit. I feel like the beam beats his blood bullet out. And I feel like he gets wasted by one of these beams. I don't think it's any match there.
Okay. So...
That is probably right. So that would put
Chad above Ganta, which would then also put him above Zoro, which I would be okay with. I mean,
it's a close match either way, so I don't have any big argument against that.
Okay, so I'm going to do that then. We're going to put Chad right below Miroku, but above Igarashi Ganta of Dead Man Wonderland. Moving on then, we reviewed MXO earlier, so let us now look at Kazumi Taiga. Again, if you have not yet read this series, this is spoiler intense, so please fast forward to anime discussion and or This Week in Manga. We are going to spoil MXO for you. Let's scroll down the list, because, now beginning spoilers, Magic Cancel is, for purposes of this tier list, is a tiebreaker only, because there is no conceivable way that a character with magic cancel could be justified above Negi Springfield, a magic user, and yet still be so weak that he would lose to Edward Elric, for example. So, for the purposes of our tier list, magic cancel is always a tiebreaker, in that we will rate a character on overall strength, and then if we narrow it all the way down to a character with magic cancel versus a magical character, then magic cancel comes into play. So, rating Kazumi Taiga on his own strength, he is essentially a brawler. A somewhat fierce brawler, granted, but he is essentially normal human, normal kid, brawler strength. So we're looking below Onizuka Eikichi of GTO, yet above Ashirogi Muto of Bakuman, because a brawler can probably take out two kids who draw manga.
Although they could probably cancel him. If they begged the editor hard enough.
That's right. Editor-in-chief would destroy him, but Ashirogi has a little ways to go. Let us look first, then, at Nijima Haruo from History's Strongest Disciple Kenichi, a brawling character versus a scheming character. Admittedly, he has a couple weapons. He has mace, he has a baton, and he has the uncanny speed of running away quite well. So, Clint, thoughts on Taiga versus Nijima?
It's kind of a slapstick matchup. I mean, you can't really say the fight would be anything but a joke fight. We can't really discuss a serious fight between these two. And my gut reaction is to say that Nijima would lose. At some point, he would be sent flying by a punch.
Right. Drew?
I feel like Taiga has enough, like, sort of like comedy hero stamina, and Nijima's sort of a comedy fighter in the first place, that he'd probably come out on top of that.
Yeah, Nijima's kind of a comedy fighter in the sense that anytime he fights, he comedically loses. So, Yeah, I'm going to give that one to Taiga as well. Let's move one notch up to Utsuru Sanada of Lock On, the celebrated legendary series Lock On. Feels so weird to still have him on this series and the tier
canceled list. Canceled character versus canceled character.
That's right.
Yeah, 99 chapters versus 18.
Yeah, does Taiga win it on series length? Sanada has the eye, the Air Gear ripoff eye, where he can basically see movements much more fluidly than a normal human. And he is a good martial artist. Is his martial art then refined enough to the point where he will beat Taiga? What do you think, Drew?
I would say no. I'd say, based on what we've seen of Sanada in series work, he fights the one signature brawler character in the series who I'd feel that Kuzumi would be at least a step above and matches up more or less evenly.
Right. I'm going to completely agree with you on that one, which puts Kuzumi Taiga in a bizarre matchup against a boxer, Makunouchi Ippo of Hajime no Ippo. At that point, does just sheer strength come into play?
At that point, the Dempsey role comes into play. Taiga's a charged, straightforward fighter, so he'd be super vulnerable to that.
Thoughts on this claim?
Yeah, Ippo just rocks Taiga. I don't see that going any way of well for him.
Right. And I agree. So we're going to move on then. He will go below Ippo, but above Sanada. Moving on then to a character that unfortunately only I know, so this will be a bit of a quick one. Killua Zoldyck, or Zoldyck, it's one of the weirdest names in all of manga and anime, from Hunter x Hunter. We're going to put his ceiling at Akisami Koetsuji of History's Strongest Disciple Kenichi and Miroku of Inuyasha as the floor. Essentially, for those unfamiliar with Killua, he is basically he's the son of an assassin's family. So he has the ability to not disappear, but kind of hide his presence, move in the shadows. So disappear from sight, but not actually like physically become invisible, for example. And more notably, later on in the series, he gains the power to electrify himself and or his little yo-yo that he carries around. And he can even kind of just electrify the air around him, create little electric arcs. So it's basically electricity, somewhat of a distance attack with his yo-yo. I mean, not long distance, but a little bit longer than human distance. And the fact that he has extraordinary speed, extraordinary quickness, agility, and the ability to hide from sight in a way. So then you guys are welcome to chime in, just judging those skills as I described them. Putting him up directly against Kagurazaka Asuna is an interesting idea because she, Clint, correct me if I'm wrong, she doesn't have blinding speed, does she? I mean, she's faster than an ordinary human, perhaps, but she's not like Bleach level speed, Magic level speed. Am I correct on that?
No, she's nowhere near as fast as some of the other characters in Negima, so I certainly wouldn't say that she's fast.
Okay. My initial impression then is that he would be able to use – it's such a weird – I'm going to say flash step because it's a completely wrong word. It's just a way to summarize this more quickly. He would be able to use the flash step to kind of hide out of sight, move around her, and he is cold-blooded. He's going to slit the throat instantly, electrify her. That is my initial impression. Do either of you have outstanding arguments against that?
No.
No, an attack from behind from the shadows probably takes her out.
Okay. Looking a few spots up then, Rock Lee of Naruto. Now, this speed, again, Killua fast, but not Rock Lee without the weights fast. Not even close. Perhaps not even with the weights on. So speed in that category, Killua would lose if that's the only category being judged. I get the feeling that the electricity wouldn't even really come into play at all here. Rock Lee, just sheer force of power, sheer quickness. Yes, there is the concept that Rock Lee would actually have to be able to see Killua to be able to take him out, but I get the feeling that, you know, both of them dropped into an arena. Rock Lee probably doesn't have the weights on. Before Killua can even make a move whatsoever, he's decimated by Rock Lee. Opinions for or against that statement, gentlemen?
I'd say that's a pretty quick win, and even if you factor in electricity, Rock Lee could probably just, like, bandage his hands with something to punch him so he wouldn't get electrocuted by attacking.
Right. Yukimura Tokine of Kekkaishi has the power to create barriers. What is the status on barriers versus different elemental types of attacks, Drew?
Barriers are fairly effective versus elemental attacks. Tokine's barriers don't have fantastic stamina, but they can typically stand up against, like, mid-level demons.
Okay. And then as for she herself, agility, speed, I mean, does that come into play at all? Is she exceptional in any category like that?
She has pretty much ordinary high school girl speed.
Okay. In that case, then, I would say if you're judging the fight as it actually would play out, I think that Killua wouldn't go for any electric attack. I think that he would use his, you know, melding into shadows move, get right behind her, and again, slit the throat. How do you feel about that sentiment?
I feel it's reasonable. She probably... I mean, it depends how quickly she gets the barrier going, and if he is that fast, then she probably just doesn't have time to get up a Kekkei.
Mm-hmm. And putting him above Tokine would also put him above Toriko, who has brute strength. Do you have any issue with that at all, Drew?
I don't know. Toriko does have distance attacks, but he doesn't have, like, ridiculous speed, and he is still sort of, like, muscle-bound. Electricity would affect him, plus he's always shirtless.
That's right. To me, Toriko doesn't really have the sense or the awareness, really, to be able to handle the moving into the shadows. And so perhaps Toriko would certainly have far more durability than other characters we've looked at in this little circle here. So Killua would have to strike him quite a few times, but I think he would be able to without taking too much damage. So I'm inclined to put Killua below Rock Lee but above Tokine. Are we okay with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And then finally this week, we're going to do six per week now. We know that that segment was getting a little bit too long. So our last entrant of the week, and this will be a fun one, is the man himself, top of his own tier list, Jack Rackin from Maho Sensei Negima. The man is pure magic. The man is pure unbridled brute strength, force, power, colossal sheer epic scale of destruction
gigantic
ability.
Gigantic freaking weapons.
Yes, just unbelievable chaos about this man.
He can manifest the arm from Big O's robot on his arm.
Pretty much. Yeah, that's pretty much exactly what it looks like. So, we are looking not just fairly high tier, we are looking top tier here. Not broken, he does not warp reality in its sense, but we are looking way at the top. Certainly, canonically, not just above Negi. I mean, far, far and away superior to Negi. So looking at Kujo Jotaro of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, we're looking at unbridled force of magic versus the ability to stop time. Is there anything... let's assume, even, that Jotaro does stop time. Let's assume that he stops time for, what, 15 seconds? Can he kill Jack Rackin?
No.
Exactly. Not with just Star Platinum.
He can't punch him down. He can't even knife him down. I don't think knives would penetrate the skin of Jack Rackin.
I think if they did,
he'd probably be just fine.
Right. So, it comes down to challenging Goku for top spot on our main tier list here. Let's review their sense of powers here. Goku of Dragon Ball, he has obviously, you know, colossal strength in his own right. He has the Kamehameha. He has basically planet-destroying capability in terms of energy beams. And what sets him apart from other Dragon Ball characters, other top-tier Dragon Ball characters, is the instant transmission ability. That's what makes him superior to Kujo Jotaro, who can stop time, is that in a flash, in the blink of an eye, or even less than that, he can appear behind you in Kamehameha, and you're absolutely vaporized. So that versus actual canonical magic, how do we feel about that? Drew, your thoughts?
I don't know how I feel about that. I think Goku with planet-busting power can probably stand up to most of Jack Rackin's power. The question is how he would inflict the death blow, which I'm still a little conflicted. Kamehameha probably would disintegrate Jack Rackin, but he's been shown to have a magical variant of that happen to him and still be fine.
Clint, I guess let's just get some more thoughts before we try to formulate decisions. What are your thoughts on this, Clint?
I mean, we've seen Jack Rackin take blows from Negi. In the stadium tournament, Negi threw absolutely everything he had at him, and Jack Rackin kind of just let him connect with all of these massive earth-shaking attacks. And he was still kind of, like, just scratched at the end. He got up and just punched Negi out.
And very briefly, it should be noted, by the way, Negi Springfield is currently third on our list. So it's not as though it's some weak character with some power, you know, a little bit of power is not doing any damage to Jack Rackin. The third character on our tier list is not doing any damage to Jack Rackin. Please continue.
So I do feel he could take hits from Goku. I also feel Goku could take hits from Jack Rackin. I mean, he himself has certainly taken plenty of punishment over the course of Dragon Ball and just gotten back up from it. Pretty much the only canonical thing that can stop him is a heart attack. It would be a little bit of a war of attrition. They would just, it would end up slugging it out foot on foot, just face to fist. And it would be a, yeah, a slug out fight.
Now, one interesting thought on this, Goku dies in the series. I mean, that's not how it ends or anything because of Dragon Balls, but he can die. Jack Rackin, on the other hand, only has been eliminated from contention so far because of a character with the ability to destroy magic. It's a very explicitly a magic cancel ability. I mean, could both of these characters actually deliver the death blow to the other? I am confident that Jack Rackin could kill Goku. You're absolutely right, Clint, in saying that it would be a war of attrition. It would take quite a long time. But I get the feeling that Jack Rackin would have the ability to kill. Could Goku do the same?
If the only way Goku could possibly kill Jack Rackin was just exhausting his energy. He's been shown to be able to be injured, but just, I'm not sure how good his ability to reconstitute himself is at the very end of his magic power line. Because it would come down to the wire between these two.
Alright, well this is quite obviously a very tough one.
We're looking at trump cards, and the kind of thing Jack Rackin was pulling out right before he was erased was battleship-sized swords being shot like a gun at the enemy. And that the arm that had, like, the first punch and then the second impact that was, like, the hammer coming down versus Goku's spirit bomb is his obvious ultimate weapon, but I don't think he would have any time to charge that during this fight.
He wouldn't have the spirit bomb. We're essentially looking at, like, giant Kamehameha.
Right.
Kamehameha.
Which is a planet-destroying attack.
I'm leaning towards Jack Rackin on the thought process that lesser characters than Jack Rackin were able to kill Goku in Dragon Ball, in my opinion. Could we at least say that the characters that killed Goku in Dragon Ball are inferior to Jack Rackin?
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that.
Now, certainly there are circumstances
about
that.
Most of Dragon Ball villains. I would certainly say that about everybody before Cell.
Right. Yeah, Cell is obviously going to be an entirely new nightmare once we finally get to him.
Above Frieza, I'm not sure about Cell. Cell, probably. Kid Buu, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that is certainly difficult. So I guess just gut feeling, and then if we disagree, we can debate it some more. My gut feeling is Jack Rackin wins this. Drew, what do you think?
I think it's going to go to Jack Rackin just because he's harder to kill.
Clint?
Yeah, through sheer force of Jack Rackin, my vote goes to Jack Rackin.
Well, it is unanimous, despite being a very difficult decision. We have a new number one at the top of our tier list, as he is the top of his own tier list, Jack Rackin of Maho Sensei Negima, now currently at the top of our main tier list. Fantastic. Okay, let us now move to our anime discussion segment. We're going to begin looking at High School of the Dead Episode 2. Drew, go ahead and begin us on that, would you please?
Well, this episode was a bit more focusing on side characters after we sort of saw the main character and his childhood friend get development in the first episode. Here we see the fencing girl, the school nurse, and the twin tails and glasses military otaku guy. They sort of get together, they fight more zombies. In a pretty interesting scene, the glasses guy improvises a nail gun out of just shop supplies. And then they make their way to the entrance of the school and start to plan what they're going to do in the future of the apocalypse world. And it was an interesting episode, sort of continuing on from the first one as just being raw exploitation.
Yeah, it's really nothing more than zombie gore action and the occasional flashes of fan service. And by occasional, I mean bountiful flashes of fan service.
Moving on, then, we're going to take a look at Seito Kai Yakuindemo, Episode 3. Clint, what's going on in this one?
Well, in Seito Kai, we've seen the two older students of the student council, the two girls, go on a trip to Kyoto and Nara, the traditional Japanese high school trip, I guess you would say. And the other two members, the small childlike girl and our protagonist, are left at the school basically doing work.
Or failing to do work.
Or failing to do work because of one's little sister.
Any particular thoughts on that episode, Drew?
It was an interesting episode. They were sort of already 3 episodes in, they're breaking up the main comedic foursome, but they manage a lot of funny gags along the way. They even parody the fact that they're breaking the group up at one point, and again, yeah, just a lot of these gags are really creative as far as they do them and well set up.
The two characters that are sent to Kyoto on the class trip are two characters that require a straight man for most of their jokes, and then the two straight men characters are the ones left at the school. So what you're seeing is these two characters in Kyoto making jokes that no one is there to, like, abuse them for.
It's a very interesting setup.
Yeah.
Legend of the Legendary Heroes, Episode 3. Drew, I believe you're the only one of us that has seen that, so please give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, this was an episode where, continuing on, Sion's party, after journeying into the meadows of what they thought was a fairly safe place, gets attacked and almost entirely massacred by a platoon of magic knights. Near the end of it, Luke goes crazy when they're about to kill Kiefer, and she and Sion are the only ones left alive. He goes crazy, massacres the entire platoon of magic knights in just like a foray of what I guess were magical laser beams. The scene was very good action, but also a little hard to follow as far as what magic he was using. And apparently Sion had to stop him by closing his eyes, which is, I guess, as far as like stopping a berserker power mode, is a moderately interesting way of doing it, rather than just like having to hug someone to get them to resume their humanity. You have to go for a specific weak point in the body. That was interesting. After that, we're treated to a little bit of loot in a prison cell, and he gives a fairly interesting speech about why he doesn't like war. It's given like with the typical lazy person attitude, but at the same time, it's interesting in its own right. It's a little deeper than that, so I was pleasantly surprised by this episode. I was sort of just watching this because it was there, but this episode I actually enjoyed, so I've got more hope for the series now.
And finally, in our anime discussion segment, we're going to take a look at episode 2 of Nurarihyun no Mago. This is the episode in which we begin to focus more on this entire concept of Nura not wanting to become the heir to the throne, essentially, the heir to the Nura clan. We meet Zen, who is kind of his sworn brother in a way, actually becomes becomes again his sworn brother directly through a sakezuki, a exchanging of sake cups. So you see the betrayal of Zen's underling against Zen, because Zen is a rather weak character, a rather weak yokai. He has great power, but that is at the expense of his own constitution, his own health. So there's an attempted betrayal, which the knight form of Nura comes and saves. So what were your thoughts on this episode? I believe you've both seen it, haven't you?
Yeah.
Okay, Clint, what did you think of this episode?
It was well done. This is my first entry into the series. I haven't yet read the manga, and I've enjoyed both episodes, and this one in particular was just, it wasn't an exception to that. It was well done, and I think the production quality could have used a little more, but it's a Shueisha title, so we're obviously going to see it do well.
Right. Drew, what did you think of this episode?
I thought it was an interesting episode. I didn't enjoy it as much as the first one, but it had some interesting bits, sort of introducing the overall world of yokai that we're seeing in vague, foreshadowy bits. And the action of the episode, like the first episode, it's very understated. It reminds me very much of Kakashi, the way this is being set up.
I see. Well, certainly a good comparison from your part there. I like the they're correctly building up the tension surrounding Gyuki, who obviously later becomes an important character as we find out in the manga, but you know, you can already tell at this point, I'm not spoiling anything, that Gyuki is an important figure in this entire conflict regarding the passing of the torch in the Nuda clan. And they are correctly building up the tension around him, especially in the conversation between him and Nurarihyun himself and Zen, Zen showing up at the request of the elder Nurarihyun. So yeah, a solid episode. So far, again, I'm current on the manga, and I have to say so far I'm satisfied. Perhaps not blown away, but satisfied with the anime adaptation thus far. Let us now begin our This Week in Manga segment, and we're going to take a look at a monthly title that we have not yet spoken about before, Sankareya, which is certainly a peculiar title, would be a word to describe it. Clint, I believe you perhaps have a better synopsis than I would.
Yeah, a boy is obsessed with zombie girls, and this ends up resulting in a girl dying who he was like partnered with for a very short time. He got to know her, and she immediately died and had drank a potion that they concocted together that turned her into a zombie. So now she lives with him as a zombie.
Yeah, I mean, not an everyday plot line, is that?
No.
It's interesting. So I guess before we discuss Chapter 8, which is the most recent chapter, what are our thoughts on the series as a whole? Drew, if you please.
I thought it was an interesting initial premise. For developing a romance, it does an okay job. Certainly, the parents of Rhea do a very good job of being villainous and sort of setting up zombies as a good side to contrast with them.
Clint, what do you think about Sankaraya?
It's well enough done. It kind of makes it seem like zombies are like this season's student council that does odd jobs around the school.
Yeah, that's a good point of note there. I have to say I'm considerably less impressed with this series. I have nothing particularly for or against zombies, although I am a rather noted advocate of Left 4 Dead 2, but that's an entirely different matter. It is granted a very odd premise to get your head around, and even though I can suspend my disbelief to some extent, the rest of the plot elements have yet to really grab me in any capacity. There are a couple interesting characters, but to me that really is the extent of it. Looking then at this chapter, Chapter 8, what happened in this chapter then, Drew?
Well, what happened was we sort of continue on from Chapter 7. Frias was kidnapped, now he's been brought to the mansion. He's sort of kept hostage by the most cliche staff of maids possible, and then he's brought to the father, and the father asks him why Rhea left, and the interesting thing is he gives a little bit of a taunting speech about why he doesn't know how he's being such a terrible father, and then he ends up getting stabbed through the chest, but then he ends up headbutting the father. So, an interesting chapter, certainly a little bit of strength shown from the main character.
Mm-hmm.
There's something interesting going on here because he doesn't seem to be bothered at all by the fact that he's been stabbed.
Yeah. Although he is bleeding.
That was the most striking moment from this chapter, is not just the headbutt. I mean, the headbutt was enough to be able to... I don't know how many of you out there have been stabbed through the chest. I'm guessing that you don't really have that much strength left over after that point. To not just the headbutt itself, but his expression on the last page after he's been stabbed, after he's delivered this headbutt, where he seems pretty much unfazed. You're right. I mean, has he had some of the potion intentionally or unintentionally? What's going on exactly? That's to me, that was the striking moment of the chapter. Anything else of note from this chapter then?
Not really.
Yeah, it was. That was the big moment, and it was a rather big moment in the context of the series, but really the rest of the chapter was pretty much set up for that moment. So we're now going to move to the weekly manga releases, beginning with One Piece Chapter 592. As was going on in last chapter, at least near the end of last chapter, we're focusing again on the crew, finally. We get to see what each of them have been up to. And as we all know, Zoro was sent originally to where Perona was, and she was kind of sort of taking care of him, bandaged him up and everything. And we come to find out that the island where they settled briefly is the island where Mihawk lives, which just absolutely shocked me when he showed up on page 3 or whatever that was. I mean, that just fantastic moment. What do you guys think about that?
If Zoro's going to get stronger, that is the way to do it.
I'm not sure if I would like him training under Mihawk. I mean, the entire point is to beat Mihawk, but I like the concept of him being around Mihawk, too. Like, the only times that we've seen Mihawk and Zoro interacting, I mean, it's the one time back at Baratier, right? Has there ever been direct interaction?
Fought with, like, the amazingly tiny knife.
Right. So this is very nice to see how far each of them have come, or really how far Zoro has come, because Mihawk has always just been this focal point of strength, the goal that Zoro is aiming for. For them to interact in kind of a pseudo-casual way is really interesting. What did you think about that meeting, Clint?
Yeah, I kind of think it's kind of building the rivalry in a friendly way. I think we've been given more than enough hints that Mihawk isn't really a villainous character. He's just kind of there as a pillar of strength that Zoro wants to test himself against. He hasn't really been killing innocents or anything like that. And I think the method of training, fighting armed gorillas, was pretty awesome.
That was great. A lot of interesting little points surrounding that island. Again, yeah, the gorillas were fantastic and funny. Mihawk mentions a battle. He very, very briefly flashes back to a battle that had taken place here that laid waste to the island. You know, my One Piece radar went off right then, thinking, oh, that's... You know, if something is quietly being mentioned, almost in passing, this probably will come up again later. Did either of you get that feeling?
It's entirely possible in the future or the past. I mean, my first impression was that it was Iggy versus Vanilla Ice, but that would have been too awesome.
Very well done. Zoro and Mihawk were not the only interesting points of this chapter. We got to see Nami, who's still up in Weatheria. Weatheria, not sure how you're supposed to say that. Classic Nami, really. I mean, you get to see her being devious, getting caught for being in trouble, and then putting on the fake tears, and then revealing that that was a lie just to get her way, but then she genuinely was crying a little bit, you know, subtly at the end. That's pretty much exactly what we would have wanted to see out of Nami, really. A nothing more, nothing less, right?
It's a typical Nami moment. You also get a little bit of, like, how she's going to power up. She stole a ton of technology from Weatheria, and she's getting away.
Yeah, I'm actually, of all the different individual power-ups that are going on, I'm not sure if I'm more excited for one over another, but, I mean, Nami's, to me, does seem like it's going to be a rather large development, because she certainly has a lot of room to develop with the Climatact, and with the technology shown up in Weatheria, yeah, very, very likely to have a serious power-up, maybe not to, you know, Zoro Sanji level of strength, in fact, almost certainly not, but it'll expand her character in an interesting way, I feel. And Frankie. Oh, Frankie. So the interesting parts of this little Frankie side story are we get to learn a little bit more again about Vegapunk. He's really subtly and well being built up over the course of hundreds of chapters, really, now. Just little bits of information coming out about him. But really, I mean, the best part of this little Frankie side story is the button. I don't know about either of you. I laughed quite loudly, audibly, when I read that moment.
Clint, that was unquestionably laugh out loud.
Clint, the button, what'd you think?
That was pretty well done. Yeah, it was pretty funny when I first ran across that.
Not even just the button, not even just the resulting explosion. The expression, the did I do that, smiling, thumbs up, winking. That just, great moment. And then finally, the last crew member we get to read about in this chapter was Pandaman. Or no, it was Satan. Or no, it was Brooke. Brooke, who kind of brought peace, sort of, to this entire group of people who were worshiping Satan. It's a really bizarre scenario, as obviously you could expect from wherever Brooke, a talking skeleton with an afro, was going to end up. But it was done in a pretty funny way. I'm wondering now how he's going to find the crew again, because all the other crew members so far, it leaves them. Certainly you don't see exactly how they're going to make it back to their meeting point, but, you know, it's open-ended. They can. Brooke is actually being kidnapped at the end of this chapter, so are they going to take him there or something? Or is it slave trade, perhaps?
Yeah, I see a pretty obvious way. I think they're just going to take him back to the archipelago and he's going to get out there.
Specifically for the purpose of the slave trade, you think?
Probably, or just selling people is what they do there, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I see him getting back there pretty easily.
That very well could be. So, overall thoughts on the chapter? I thought it was, you know, maybe not the most meaningful chapter, but funny and really enjoyable.
Yeah, fun and something we've been looking forward to, seeing the crew again.
Right. Naruto, chapter 502, in which we get to see the bulk of the Minato and Madara fight, which I found to be rather good, actually. There was, at the beginning of the chapter, you get to see a lot of reaction shots as to what's going on from characters we know in the present, back when they were in the past, Kakashi, Gai, etc. You know, parents of a lot of the children from present day. But really, the most important part of the chapter is the fight itself, and I found it to be fantastic, really. Really, the only thing that held this back from being an overwhelmingly amazing chapter was the fact that the fight did not encompass the entire chapter. Excellent techniques used, being shown from both people. Really well done art, wouldn't you say? I mean, very specifically, the sequence with the kunai passing through Madara's head, I found to be excellent. What did you think about this, Clint?
Yeah, it was one of the best fights we've seen in Naruto, which Naruto is kind of coming to do this often now. I want to say, like, with the fight with the fox between Naruto and the fox, and now this fight, it's just been exceptional for a while now. And this fight was so great, so fun to watch, and, like, I definitely feel like, hope we haven't seen the end of it. I hope there's more to the fight than this. Hopefully all of next chapter will be a continuation of this fight.
Mm-hmm. Drew, what do you think of this?
I think it did particularly a really good job of setting up Minato's thoughts in the middle of the fight. Beyond protecting the village, he's actually thinking of a way to defeat Madara, like, carefully considering everything. I thought that was interesting. The way it was set up and the way he threw his knife through Madara and then teleported behind him reminded me of Law of Ueki. And whenever a fight reminds me of Law of Ueki, it's a good thing.
You made a very interesting point that relates more to Beamcast and the Great Shonen Tier List than anything to do with Naruto in particular, which was, you know, the three of us are kind of silently rooting for this fight to go on for a little while, not just because it's so far shown to have been a good fight, but because we want to see more techniques, because if we get the chance to tier Minato as a character, having enough of a background in techniques to tier him, he's going to go pretty damn high, because some of the stuff he was doing was just fantastically powerful, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
I feel like he has the edge in speed to almost anyone else by quite a margin.
Yeah, it's really nice to find more out about him.
Outright teleportation with some of his techniques, even.
Yeah, really nice to find out more about Minato. It really redeems a lot of the earlier Naruto. I was kind of, for a while, becoming frustrated the way that it was just, the series was so reverential in tone about the Fourth and how glorious the Fourth was, and it was just going on and on for hundreds of chapters with no real factual basis shown to us. Now we finally get to see it, and while I feel it took a little bit too long, given how highly they were praising him, it's certainly been well worth the wait, at least. He's not disappointed in his levels of power.
Even in going one-on-one with people, as opposed to just, like, having these giant summon wars that big ninjas have.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something else that stands out. That's an excellent point. That's probably why I've enjoyed this fight more than a lot of the fights between Jiraiya, Tsunade, Orochimaru, and all them. This isn't just a summon fest. This is actually technical, precise fighting. Yes, there are techniques involved, but it's a lot more direct. I'm really enjoying that. Let's move now to Bleach Chapter 412, where Matsumoto finally steps up and kind of, sort of does something, maybe. We don't know. Matsumoto, Rangiku, has been shown chasing after Aizen, but more specifically chasing after Gin, for many chapters in little one-page segments at the end or near the end of each chapter. She finally catches up. She's just kind of suddenly standing right in front of them, bizarrely. That wasn't set up well at all. And Gin decides, you know, I'm going to take care of this personal business myself, whisks her away. So you're thinking, maybe Gin is, you know, not completely on even terms with Aizen after all. Maybe he is kind of good or something. Whisks her away. They show down for a moment. And then the action completely cuts away from that. I can't say disappointed regarding Bleach anymore because I have no hopes for Bleach, but that was really insulting to me, the way that if you build something up, at least have the decency to show the resulting action from that build-up. Don't cut away from it.
To me, there was an issue even before that point. Her showing up in the last chapter was completely incoherent, because I had no idea she was right there. That panel from last chapter was incredibly poorly drawn, and it is kind of a cop-out to have her do nothing after showing up after all this time. But that's what Bleach characters kind of do.
That's a good point. Right before Gin whisk her away, the entire scene, there's been a lot of really awkward, out-of-place comedy in Bleach lately, which is just... It feels so awkward, so wrong to have just moments of Rangiku yelling at Don Kananji to run away when they're facing off with this world-consuming, powerful villain right there. Totally out of place, totally unacceptable, really. And then the potential twist this week is when one of Ichigo's friends picks up a sword that he said he found by Mr. Afro. Did either of you have any idea who he's talking about?
Yeah, the Soul Reaper assigned to Karakura Town, who no one ever really pays attention to. He's just a guy with an afro.
Oh, so great. That's not even really a full-on twist. It's just that a character who has already been kind of established as less important is further reinforced as less important then.
Yeah.
Great.
Unless he's secretly superpowered.
His bankai is that he needs to... It would be a horrible twist. That is, and you're probably right. That's probably what's going to happen. I can't rule anything out at this point. His bankai is probably something like, well, I need some random unassociated boy to pick up my sword so that I am able to transform into a powerful being.
Gundam.
Yeah, Gundam. He's a Gundam. That's it.
Those who have seen a Gundam shall not live. Those who have read Bleach will not enjoy themselves.
Oh my goodness. Anything at all else to talk about on this one? It was a pretty bad chapter. Surprise, surprise.
Rangiku might be dead at the end.
Yeah, maybe. Who knows? If she is alive, if it was not a killing blow, can we then really seriously start to give credence to the idea that Gin is maybe not good, but has different motives from Aizen?
Yeah, I would certainly say so. If he kind of barely spared her, like certainly like gave her a wound to like protect her from Aizen in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel the same way. I don't really care if that's what happens. I just want something to happen at all. Do something. All right, Bakuman, chapter 94, where they find that the ultimate problem holding them back is the lack of a plus sign. That's pretty much the entire chapter. No. What happened in this chapter? We had, it's kind of an offbeat chapter, a lot of focus on a lot of different places. A good comedy chapter in the sense of the tea party arranged by the two editors, where they're trying to get Hiramaru, you know, the entire Shizuka Hiramaru storyline going on with both of them being really quirky, offbeat characters. You have the one who's focused so passionately on Aokiko and the other one who just very secluded, very antisocial. So two very different results from the horribly, horribly awkward tea party. One of them was Hiramaru going crazy over the fact that the tea was the wrong tea. But to me, far more interestingly, was the result on Shizuka's side of it, where he's now become kind of even more despondent, even more frustrated with women, the way that they treat people like him. And it looks as though he's going to turn around and put that into his manga. Thoughts on the way that panned out then, Clint?
It seemed to work out pretty well, in a figurative sense, I guess. It was certainly a very, very awkward tea party.
Yeah.
And Aoki and her assistants, like the looks on their faces while stuff was going on, was almost priceless. But whatever manga he's going to produce out of this, and if he becomes like a mainstay or a rival or jumps up the charts, it could be interesting for PCP.
Mm-hmm. Focusing then back on Ashirogi and PCP, they do find out that the one thing that was holding them back was obviously not the plus line. It was the fact that Mashiro's art was really inappropriate. It was too dark. There was too much screen tone. There wasn't enough, you know, precise, light-hearted inking. I thought that was a really good way to resolve whatever it was that was holding them back. How did you feel about that?
That was really interesting, and it made me think. I went back to Death Note, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Looked at chapter 5 or so, and then looked again at a chapter in the 80s, and you could see a noticeable change. During the run of Death Note, the art style changed to a lighter, less tone-heavy drawing style from the very early to the later chapters. So there was definitely a little bit of self-reference going on there.
It's an extremely good observation. Thank you for doing that research. I would not have known that. There was a couple other things in this chapter. A very curious, odd moment between Heiji and Iwase. Iwase, who the last couple of chapters has been kind of the more respectful rival, and she seems, honestly, I take back a little bit what I've said the last couple of weeks. She seems to be evolving into that role nicely. It was a shocking change for her, which is why I was a little bit put off by it. But in this new role, now that she's establishing herself as the respectful rival rather than the woman scorned, it could work very well because it could let her compliment and not overshadow Eiji. But the odd moment comes in when Eiji praises her and you know, holds her hand and tells her how talented she is as a writer. And she's taken aback, shocked, visibly blushes and says, you know, talented? So could it actually be that someone has a crush on Eiji?
That would be glorious to see. I would love to see, like, a romance plot. If they were, like, between Mashiro and Azuki, in Eiji and Iwase, if Eiji and Iwase were the first ones to, like, hook up and start being together, that would be hilarious.
Yeah, I never would have predicted this, but if it happens, you know, I don't even know how to... It's great. It's great in a completely unusual, bizarre way, but it's great. Anything else from this chapter? I mean, the bold statement at the end from a pseudo prediction from Eiji saying that, you know, it's time to start watching out for PCP and for Mashiro because of his art. You know, they've turned around.
Eiji is this series like indicator of what's truly going on. He's known to be almost a prophet of manga in that he knows exactly what's going to happen. So I do feel that we've got a moving up the charts coming for PCP. They're going to go back up to what they were before.
So then final thoughts on this chapter then, but not so much on this chapter as thoughts on the series resulting from this chapter. If PCP is then going to take off and be their major success, do you at all get the feeling that Bakuman could be a comparatively short series?
It could run short. I mean, pending any, you know, universal plot change, like something large and momentous happening, pending any of that, it could end fairly soon.
Mm-hmm. You know, a quality short series versus a stretched out long series, I'd certainly take the former over the latter any day of the week. Bakuman's been entertaining me throughout, very much so. But yeah, right now I get the feeling that it's going to end. We're closer to the end than the beginning at this point, I guess is a way to say it. Let's move now to Beelzebub chapter 69, which is largely a setup chapter, but there were some quite funny moments. In fact, very early on in the chapter, we had a blatant Shonen Jump parody referencing. There's the two characters, Bosun and Switch from Sket Dance, are there doing whatever, being silly. And then we had a few characters from Siren at a different stand in this area. So not really at all the important parts of this chapter, but rather funny. I found that funny. I don't know what you guys thought of it.
Nice little self-referential bit, especially considering the guy who does Beelzebub was once an assistant for the author of Siren.
Right. Yeah, Kyle really is just too cool to keep in one series, really. That's the major issue. So you have this entire maid cafe scene where, you know, Furuichi comes into the maid cafe and is rather creepily used to that kind of a scenario. Knows exactly what to say, what to order, how to order it. I mean, this was a setup chapter, but the comedy moments were done very well, very specifically with regard to Furuichi, who is you know, priceless comedian in this series.
Priceless,
what did you think
predator.
Of the
omelet with Predator was great.
Oh,
and, like,
funny.
Everyone, like, the airhead is surprisingly knowledgeable. Like, she knows exactly what kind of guy he is.
We had then the horsemen show up and take care of the guys that were coming to try to ruin this festival. So we had that bizarre sense of a dual sense of morality where, you know, yes, the six horsemen have been set up as the antagonists. We've seen them do bad things, and yet they're still loyal to their school. They're still doing the right thing and kind of weeding out the trash that's coming in and trying to ruin that. Did you take anything away from those scenes at all, Drew?
It was an interesting scene. Sort of reminded me of Smoker from One Piece when he was really introduced as a character. But it was interesting. Okay, we already know the horsemen are powerful, so not much to be added there.
Right. And then the thing probably to be taken away from the chapter most is the character who was mixed in with all of those thugs from Tamo, the long-haired character who a few people took notice of. Any thought? I mean, do we have any way of knowing who this is, what he's up to, anything at all?
I haven't even seen his face. No idea.
Right. I mean, the only piece of foreshadowing that is yet outstanding in the series that we have yet left to resolve is the demon lurking within the school that Hildegard and Elendilon talked about a few chapters ago. Could be him, but it would be rather unusual to kind of debut that character in the midst of a sports festival, I get the feeling. I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, I don't know, but they did set up for the demon, and now we do have this mysterious individual, so it kind of would follow that this is the demon.
Could be. But again, largely a setup chapter, so we're not going to take a look at Fairy Tale 192. What happens in this chapter, Drew?
The Erza and Erza fight continues to be not resolved. There's just horrible dialogue. I'm not sure if this is a Scanlation thing or not, but just the dialogue this chapter felt incredibly childish and poorly written.
I don't think it was the Scanlations. I know exactly the type of problem you're talking about. This time I don't feel it was the Scanlation. This time I feel it was the original writing. Stilted, awkward, childish. You're absolutely right. There was the beginning of the Erza and Erza fight, or the part two of the Erza versus Erza fight, and that was kind of it. They cut away again. Unbelievably frustrating. Cuts back to the king kind of decimating everyone, and then ultimately, who comes to save the day but Fairy Tail, the guild. Do you care? Because I didn't.
I did not. It was profoundly uninteresting, sort of like, also kind of throws away, like, I was okay with the cats, oddly enough, when they did this. I'm not okay with Fairy Tail because they're supposed to be cowards in this universe.
Right.
Sort of turns everything on its head this way and makes the whole arc feel kind of like a sham.
It, again, childish is the perfectly appropriate word to use because you get the feeling that it's going to be Fairy Tail showing up and overcoming the fact that they're cowards and learning to live for themselves in this own world because the quote-unquote real Fairy Tail teaches them the right way to act as a guild, which is just, I mean, that's the most
it's
base.
It's weak, and does that mean that Fairy Tail is going to learn to be cowardly in Earthland? Because other than that, I see no way to salvage this arc. And this particular twist of this arc.
I see. I don't see that happening, and I see no way to salvage this at all. So, nothing else that I have to say about this. Hayate no Gotoku, chapter 280, in which we meet a new character who is a girl who's almost exactly like Hayate, another debt-ridden, soon-to-be part of the main cast. How do you feel about a new girl joining the cast here?
If there's any time to introduce someone new like that, it's probably now when we're still kind of in that transition. I mean, it's been a couple chapters, but we're still fresh off of Athena. I'm pretty sure no one's forgotten the Athena arc. So I feel like it's the right place to maybe introduce some new faces and kind of like, it's almost like a new start. We have a new house that they're living in. So it fits.
Yeah, I can see that. It's just... That is a little bit bizarre to have a character who is almost identical to Hayate, because how is she going to play into the harem, into the comedy? I mean, comedically, she's going to hit on all the same points that Hayate already hits on, so she wouldn't be offering too much in terms of variety there. And then if she's just supposed to be a love interest for Hayate because she's exactly the same, I think we have enough love interest at this point. Yes, they're being used largely for comedic purposes, but still, I mean, the harem is pretty damn big at this point. That was really the extent of the entire chapter, was it not?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. History's Strongest Disciple Kenichi, chapter 390. We've complained recently about fan service. Can we even call it fan service at this point?
You can still call it fan service because there's no penetration going on, but that's basically it.
Yeah, they keep her panties on, which is all that you can say of it, pretty much. So it basically amounts to softcore porn.
I was legitimately very disappointed. Yes, this was supposed to be a ma fight. So, going into it, I'm aware there's going to be fan service, etchy moments, etc. I'm respectful of that, even if I'm not big. You know, if you want to watch hentai, watch hentai. I don't need it mixed into my other series. That's my entire point. But this went so far above and beyond just fan service to me that it completely detracted from what could have been a couple good moments. I mean, we've not really seen Ma in exactly this kind of like a fatherly sort of light. It could have been interesting development for him. To me, at least, I'm not trying to speak for either of you, but to me, at least, it really ruined it with the sheer amount of borderline hentai. I mean, how did you feel about the transformation in Ma's character in this fight in comparison to what happened around it?
What I feel like, it's not so much the hentai, the like nudity in this chapter was bad. It was very bad. What really got to me was just like the reason why she took it off. After like Ma uses his stripping technique on part of it, she just like takes the rest of her armor off because why?
Yeah.
It just seems like that was without even any reason given to it. It's just useless fan service.
I mean, it was a little bit of character development. If this had been a character that we had been seeing, like we saw with the Chinese Kenpo user that we saw earlier, who wears the helmet and the pads, and we saw her father treating her like a piece of dirt. That was character development to where we had grown to care about her. This is someone who just got introduced. We expected it to be like a faceless person who just got fought. And they're kind of trying to make us care about her. Like, when she strips off the rest of her clothing, she kind of says, like, I no longer think of myself as a female. I'm just a warrior and assassin, and I'm heartless. And then they have Ma trying to, like, be a father and bring her back to being, like, a good person again. And I do feel it's interesting character development, but I don't feel that we have any reason to care about this woman.
Yeah, I totally agree. There was maybe, what, one redeeming moment in this chapter. I found it actually pretty damn funny when he folded the clothing. That was a pretty funny moment to me. I don't know.
That was a good joke.
Did you guys find anything else enjoyable in this chapter?
Nah.
Okay. Moving on then, we're going to take a look at Toriko chapter 102, which is back from its 1 week break. We have training, basically, between Toriko and Ichiryu, which... this is supposed to be a spar. I don't know if you would... That would be a very kind way of putting it, really. This is basically Toriko showing off everything that he's learned using his... he has a 13-hit fork now, and he has the leg fork and the leg knife. And it, you know, a decent evolution in his attacking strength, and it doesn't amount to anything in the face of Ichiryu, who grabs his final attack with just his one hand and then pummels him. Ichiryu, obviously being the mentor character here, is going to set him up for a training, a pseudo-training arc. He's going to send him off to look for a new ingredient, which he thinks should belong on Toriko's full course, which is intended to serve as an entire training arc for Toriko to expand his strength as a character. What are your thoughts overall on this chapter, then? A lot of different things to talk about.
Well, there was a lot of interesting stuff this chapter, certainly. I really like the fact that it's not just a training arc he's sending him on. He's sending him on an actual job to get food and hopefully add something to the full course.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the interesting thing was he was highlighting about ice hell. Somehow you have to be able to get your breath not to freeze in order to survive in the gourmet world.
Right.
So it shows that Toriko sort of is good enough strength-wise, but not gourmet cell body control level-wise, which is... an interesting and well-thought-out point for a series that basically creates a world in and of itself.
Absolutely. There are a lot of different series where, I mean, overall in Shonen, you kind of have to self-handicap your main character at certain points, because if he's too overpowered for the entire series, it's very boring. This is an extremely good way of doing it. It's not just introducing a new broken character who Toriko has to just then linearly train to beat. It's saying that, yes, you do have – you are more than capable in terms of strength, but you have to alter your own cells of your body to adapt for the chance to use that strength. Again, I totally agree with you. Very, very good way of doing that. And I also agree with you in the sense that I'm glad this is not just a straightforward training arc. It is an arc with a purpose, which will ultimately train Toriko, but it is not just straightforward, boring training. So this chapter in and of itself might not have been the most interesting, but what it's setting up for is very promising, in my opinion.
Very interesting. Hopefully we'll get a chance to see Terry Cloth in action again.
Oh, definitely. I miss my Terry. The World God Only Knows, chapter 106. Drew, could you please give us a synopsis on this chapter?
Oh, following on from chapter 105, we see the date, double date that Kama set up and went on, and he doesn't really get any information out of Diana or Hakua, but he does inform them that he has his own plan to simultaneously check all the girls that he at one point captured for goddesses and then sends them on a water park ride.
Clint, how did you feel about this chapter then, still continuing what we were going through last chapter?
It's a big setup chapter is what I get the feeling for what's going to be like kind of the festival mini arc of him going around and looking for goddesses, which looks to me like it's going to be a really fun arc. I'm kind of excited for it. And the interplay between Diana / Tenri and Hakua was pretty good.
Yeah, I agree. I'm really looking forward to the next arc. I guess in that sense, I'm kind of not enjoying this chapter and the last one as much as perhaps I should be, simply because I really want to get to Kama's search for the goddesses. But it is setting it up effectively, in my opinion. And there were some good comedy moments, like you said, sending him on the water ride. And the moment when he's playing the shooting gallery game, was also quite funny. Again, his insatiable lust to conquering any female in anything that can conceivably be called a game. So some decent comedy in this one. Any other thoughts on this chapter?
Not particularly. It's an interesting setup chapter. That's it.
Right. Okay, Siren, chapter 127. We have a clear division in the groups that are attacking the Wise compound. Frederica shows up and begins her fight with Uranus, and she is shortly thereafter joined by Kyle. So the division of the group here is Kyle and Frederica, and then as we see later in the chapter, Shao and Kabuto, which I feel, just commenting on those alone, should be really interesting the way that they complement each other power-wise, don't you think?
It's a very good chemistry just putting together those two sets of powers, those two sets of personalities. And the fight that we've seen thus far involving Kyle and Frederica has been just incredibly well drawn, particularly when Kyle enters the fray, of course.
Yeah.
The one panel where he's just getting bombarded by Uranus and puts up a triple set of barriers. Fantastic art.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that comment of yours should stand apart from any other comment that we could make, because you don't often comment on art. And I completely echo that statement. Really, really, not just well drawn, but well designed. The way that it's choreographed, the way that the angle, the, you know, quote unquote camera angle that we see it from, that page, I believe it was page 14, fantastic page. The other elements of this chapter, a little bit more unusual. We get to see a few scenes of the Wise, kind of in their own headquarters, talking a little bit more casually. One of them's talking to Marie. A couple of them are talking about their sense of belonging in this world. One of them focusing on, you know, fighting being his sole purpose of living at this point. I found this a little bit odd, based solely on the fact that we've not really seen or heard from the Wise much at all, except for just being the antagonists. It's not to say that I don't want development of them, it's just that we haven't had it up till now, and to suddenly have a decent amount of it felt awkward to me. Did you feel either way about that?
That felt a little bit out of place. I would have liked to see more development in the past, but I think we've seen enough of Grana for this to just be supplementary, and to certainly have him set out and possibly fight Kabuto and Zhao makes sense at this point.
Mm-hmm. Overall, then, largely a fight chapter. Again, great action between Kyle, Frederica, and Uranus, and then Shao and Kabuto looking forward very much to the next chapter, or whenever it is that they begin their fights with whoever they fight against. I found it to be a good chapter. Do you feel the same?
Yeah, it's definitely moving very rapidly.
Right. Hajime no Ippo, chapter 900, certainly a fantastic milestone. Congratulations to George Morikawa for lasting so long and providing us with such a great manga overall. This is the outset, right before the actual beginning of the Class A tournament, through some matches that we don't get to see, and we end right before Itagaki's match is about to begin. Certainly, I mean, the step up in quality from where we had been just a few weeks ago is certainly noticeable. Wouldn't you say so, Drew?
Already it feels like we're back in the classic Ippo, with Itagaki, Kimura, and Aoki all setting up for their own fights, and Itagaki in particular just sort of revving himself up. It definitely feels like we're entering a good fight arc again, just by the setup of it.
Definitely agree. Clint, how do you feel about this chapter?
Yeah, it's a setup chapter, but I'm pretty excited for what it's setting up. I want to get into these fights. I want to see Ippo fights that I'm going to enjoy again. I'm really interested to see how Itagaki is going to do in his fight, if he's going to be able to meet his goal.
Mm-hmm. They're really setting up for something major here with regard to just how overwhelmingly ever-present Ippo was in cheering on Itagaki. He was always the smiling face, the cheering voice that was very obviously grating on Itagaki himself. I get the feeling, at least, that this is going to blow up in some capacity. Who knows if that's him dominating his fight or not being able to focus and either losing his fight or not even coming close to breaking the record. I mean, I just get the feeling that a notable plot point involving that relationship is about to unfold. Do you feel at all the same way, Drew?
I'm kind of predicting that Itagaki, based on the setup that's been going, especially if he can't reach his goal here, I think that makes it very likely that he'll leave the gym and go to Mashiba's gym.
Very interesting idea. Yeah, that very well could happen. Good point. Anything else that you'd like to comment on from this chapter, either of you?
Not particularly. It was nice getting to see some of the background characters we haven't seen in a while, the doctor and Itagaki's rival.
Cheetah pants guy.
Yes. Yeah, but obviously, largely a setup chapter again, and very much looking forward to the next few chapters. And frankly, the entire next arc is looking like the Ippo of old that we all fell in love with. Otago, Chapter 27, which was certainly a diversion from the recent action, the recent serious, intense moments that we've been having surrounding Patchman and Ewan and all this. This is a date with an old woman who's a ghost.
And buying panties for her.
Yeah, it was the comedy moments were funny, and the heartwarming moment at the end of it where the woman knew all along that it was Otago and not Ewan, and compliments Otago on his own. I mean, it pulled off both senses quite well, I thought. How did you feel about this chapter?
Mm-hmm. It pulled off a nice little sixth sense thing, you know, back when M. Night Shyamalan was good. It had the whole comedy scene where, like, he was shopping with the old lady and Rio and Coco saw him, and obviously then they saw him by himself, but he didn't know that.
Right. He's just caught holding panties and talking to the air around him. So sets up some interesting moments of comedy. And for the record, I take offense to that statement. M. Night Shyamalan was never good, in my opinion. yeah, good. I mean, certainly not a pivotal chapter in the series, but a really enjoyable one, at least. That concludes our weekly group discussion. I'm going to briefly take you through what I read. Air Gear I've caught up on recently. And just in case you were wondering, no, I have no idea what's going on either. You're not alone. Chapter 284 begins the raid of a small group of forces on the battleship or cruiser, wherever they are, this large U.S. boat that's under control of the enemy. And President Obama, or pardon me, President John Omaha of the United States of America in the series, who is, by the way, in case you're wondering, still body swapped with a little girl, makes this impassioned speech as they begin this outset, the outset of this assault on the boat, where he believes that in the coming generations, the children will refer to him as Funky Fresh. And There was some more action, but really, I mean, that page, I think it was page 5 of chapter 284, just go read it for yourself. You don't really need to worry about spoilers with Air Gear, because even if you've read from the beginning, as I have no idea what is going on. You've heard me previously talk about De Grey Man not having any idea what's going on. This is an entirely new level of esoteric and nonsensical. De Grey Man is the most concise thing in the world compared to Air Gear. Clear action, at least a good sense of the female figure if you're into fan service, you know, certainly not it's a different level from Kenichi. Even I mean, there are blatantly just naked women, completely naked, without panties even, and this is running in Weekly Shonen Magazine, so blurring the lines between shonen and seinen, or even hentai sometimes. Decently enjoyable, but as a mindless, if you're the type that likes to go see a summer action flick, read Air Gear. Katakushi Hitman Reborn was a revelation that Enma is broken and we're about to hit a training arc. This is really, really worrisome. All the future arc villains and all the future arc heroes even were becoming way too suave, way too cool, confident. This was supposed to be about these mostly awkward kids with powers thrust upon them, and they were thrust consequently into an awkward situation. Right back here, we're going back to this weird sense of everyone just too confident, particularly Enma, who's at 1/7 of his strength right now, and he's just decimating everyone from the current Vongola family. It's very obviously time for a training arc, and I'm not looking forward to that, nor am I looking at all forward to the battles that are going to take place following that. I was slightly optimistic for this after the future arc, simply because of how terrible that was, but I've lost all that optimism. And finally, Kimi no Iromachi Chapter 97 came out today, in which a really bizarre and frankly kind of funny plan is hatched to get Kiyomi alone with Kazuma to be able to kiss him, in which the plan is ridiculous to the point where she knows that Kazuma likes peaches, so she's brought peaches and has deliberately forgotten to bring a can opener, so that'll give an excuse for Haruto and Eba to leave the room to go buy a can opener so that she can kiss him. And of course it's a comedy of errors, because she buys the wrong peaches, and she has no concept of how to tell the other characters to run off to buy a can opener, and she becomes so vocal about it that he just ends up saying, well, why don't you just go buy it yourself? And oh, by the way, she accidentally bought a can with a tab on it, so she didn't even need a can opener. The whole thing was just stupid. And then at the end, all of a sudden, for such a lighthearted, funny chapter, total swerve at the end where both of the characters come back to the hospital room and peek in and see Eba and Kazuma laughing and smiling and decide, you know, I'm not going to interfere with this, even though it breaks both of our hearts to see the people that we love with each other and not us. We're not going to interfere with it because we just like to see them smile. for such a comedy chapter, that was a really odd moment at the end to really break that up. That concludes the entirety of This Week in Manga. I'm going to take a look at our chapters of the week now. Clint?
My chapter of the week is One Piece. It was done exceptionally well. It is almost what I would like to call classic One Piece. It's just going back to, like, seeing interesting characters doing interesting things in interesting places. It's just everything about it was well done. The art was, as always, great.
Drew?
My chapter of the week is One Piece. It was pure fun, especially Frankie.
My chapter of the week was One Piece. Yeah, all the focus on the different characters was fantastic, and frankly, to me, the best moment was seeing Mihawk. That just absolutely blew me away. Loved it. Thank you very much for listening to the entirety of this week's Beamcast. Please check us out on our social networks. Check all the links on the site for Facebook, Twitter, my anime list, and please, again, feel free to email us, shonenbeam@gmail.com. Next week on Curtain Classic, we're going to take a look at Toriko and Devilman, a classic there. Final Flash.
Bananas don't count as snacks.
Congratulations to PS Gels for winning the Anti-Blog tourney.
Shakhtar Donetsk is interested in Eduardo. Arsene Wenger, please sell him. Thanks very much for listening. Good night.